Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Okay. Now, this afternoon, thought we would. Something I was avoiding very specifically in the morning, which was to look at. We have actually a chapter in the Samyutta Nikaya, the connected discourses, which is the connected discourses on views. And this is, it's not very long chapters, it's 12, 14, 16 suttas, very small, very repetitive, about a whole bunch of different kinds of views. And again, most of us would find that these are not hot button issues in our lives. Yeah, is does a Tathagata exist after death? We just don't get in arguments about these things. Yeah, but I think there's still some merit in approaching these lists and realizing that someone somewhere somehow does hold to this view, or it would not have been brought up. And in some ways, when we talk about views, like I said, in a greater cosmological way, views are viewpoints, and viewpoints are essential to vision, a vision in the way of perceiving objects, of just how the mind comes to know anything, yeah, and that's at its most basic level. But what happens when we start piling all of this other stuff on there is that we see that somewhere along the way, this completely essential fundamental process, that is not self, that is not an aspect of ourself, that is happening anyway, gets taken possession of. And the mind starts to do things to this process. One of the first things it does is it construes vision and knowledge, as we talked about this morning, and it confuses them as being part of the same thing. It says, I am a person who has vision and knowledge. I see things and I know things. The things I see, I know them. The things I know, I see them. And it misperceives that these are two separate things happening. Yeah. And that what we know is not necessarily what we see. What we see is not necessarily what we know, and that both are arising and ceasing in their own ways, and that they condition each other very heavily. And so it's not so surprising, actually, that we would think that they were the same thing. It's almost obvious they're part of a whole, unless we looked at each one individually and realized it didn't need the other one. Yeah, it's being conditioned, but it's not dependent on the other one. And that's when it starts to unravel. And we start to see there is all of these things that come later in the development of a mind moment, in the development of our mind, in the development of us from a child who only sees, doesn't really know much of anything, to an adult who knows everything and refuses to see. Right? How does that process come about? And it's actually a very natural process that the Buddha points to in some of these suttas. And even though he uses these seemingly bizarre viewpoints, if we simply apply the stamp and know that, wait, this is a viewpoint, it means it is describing somebody's perspective, then we know that it's no different than any other viewpoint. It is meant to arise and cease. And that the problem came when it was clung to, when somebody somewhere somehow said, no, this is true. No, wait, this is stable. This is permanent. This is reliable. This is consistent. The thing was, they were wrong, right? And maybe it's a very pleasing view to them. Or maybe it was a very displeasing view. There's a very funny, interaction with the Buddha where he comes across an ascetic who says, I hold the view that all views are displeasing to me. And he was like, "Oh, okay. It sounds like we're on the same wavelength. He doesn't like views." And the Buddha looked at him and he goes, "Well, is that view also displeasing to you? Are you holding a displeasing view? It might just turn out if you investigate it." This is, I'm paraphrasing, but like that, you seem to think that that one view, that all other views are displeasing, is a pleasing view. Otherwise, why would you hold to it? If even your own view was displeasing, would you not have abandoned all views? And this is what we're trying to get to, what we're trying to understand, is that views arise and cease. They are viewpoints. They are perspectives. Yeah, they are only a problem when we use them as a way of saying this is a thing. This is the same thing. This is a stable thing. This is truth. Pretty much whenever we do that, we're wrong. Because if the viewpoint can arise, the viewpoint can cease. If the viewpoint is impermanent, then it's not always that way. If it's not always that way, then it's not really reliable, is it? If it's not reliable, do we really want to hold to it? Do we really want to keep coming back to it? Or should we maybe try to find another way to be? We don't need to be stuck in viewpoints. We can have values, and these values can evolve over time, and they can help us learn and grow and evolve into what we want to put our energy into. Yeah. But to develop the wisdom to do that, the Buddha gives us, it's just a couple of pithy phrases and formulas that show that, this thing that we do with with views is the problem, is the very root, the taproot of the problem. Yeah. And this is why the breaking of the fetter of views, the outflow of views, the pollution of views is stream entry. Yeah. Because without us holding to a viewpoint, we can't cling to an object because we will see that object as impermanent. We will be forced to let it go over and over again because we don't hold the view that it's the same thing that we're perceiving, is the same perspective. We will start changing our perspective from time to time, and when we do that, things start breaking in terms of samsara, good in a good way. The things that we want to break. This horrible mechanism of endless rebirth breaks because the fundamental thing that was required, that we would take a viewpoint and hold to it and cultivate it and believe that it was permanent, satisfying, and somehow defined us, we stopped doing that. And we're like, wow, views suck. As soon as one arises, we're like, ah, that's so heavy. I wish I could just get out from under this. That's wisdom. So I'm going to press this button and we're going to see what happens. Maybe a sutta will come up. Maybe it won't. Let us see. A sutta came up. So this is the first sutta in Samyutta Nikaya, chapter 24, and this is the Samyutta on views, the Ditthi At one time, the Buddha was staying near Sawati, Jetta's Grove, and the Buddha said this: "Monks, when what exists, because of grasping what and insisting on what, does a view such as this arise?" And again, we can put any view here. "Winds don't blow, rivers don't flow, pregnant women don't give birth, the moon and stars neither rise nor set, but stand firm like a pillar." It might sound like a completely bizarre notion, but even in this day and age, there are physicists who are suggesting from time to time that maybe time is an illusion, yeah? That really what we have is a bunch of discrete moments. And that the objects in those moments are actually static. They are not moving. And it's only because that we go like a flip book from one to the next so that we imagine there is movement. And so they form a view based on this. You'd be like, oh, those silly people in ancient India. Just like, this stuff doesn't stop happening. And the monks say something very pleasing here, and we were talking about refuge, and this is what refuge sounds like. They say, our teachings are rooted in the Buddha. He is our guide and refuge. Sir, may the Buddha himself please clarify the meaning of this. The monks, us, will listen and remember it. And the Buddha says, well then, mendicants, listen and apply your mind well. I will speak. So the monks are saying, like, look, we have some ideas about what causes these views, but we'd much rather hear from you, the Buddha, and what you say, we will remember, we will repeat, we'll pass among ourselves. And that's what it's like to take refuge in the Buddha as a teacher, is to be like, yeah, I have my own ideas, but maybe you can say it better. Let me listen. Let me attend to it. And maybe I'll get understanding from that. And then, yes, sir, they replied. And the Buddha said this, when form exists because of grasping form and insisting on form, the view arises. Yada, 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 yada. So what do you think, monks? Is form permanent or impermanent? And they say, impermanent, venerable sir. He says, but if it's impermanent, is it suffering or happiness? And they say, well, that would be suffering. He says, but by grasping what's impermanent, suffering, and perishable, but by not grasping what's impermanent, suffering, and perishable, would a view such as this arise? And they say, no, sir. That view couldn't arise if you weren't grasping something impermanent, suffering, and perishable. And he continues for the other four khandhas. So he's showing the five khandhas, five aggregates, in the three ways. They're impermanent, they're suffering, they're not self. He goes on to say, that which is seen, heard, thought, known, attained, sought, and explored by the mind, is that permanent or impermanent? And they say, impermanent. Again, they're not saying it doesn't exist, they're saying it changes. Yeah, it arises and ceases. But if it's impermanent, is it suffering or happiness? Suffering. But by grasping what's impermanent, suffering, and perishable, but by not grasping what's impermanent, suffering, and perishable, would such a view arise? They say, no, venerable sir. So the Buddha says, when a noble disciple has given up doubt in these six cases, they have given up doubt in suffering, its origin, its cessation, and the practice leading to its cessation. They're called a noble disciple who is a stream enterer, not liable to be reborn in the underworld, bound for awakening. So, for a minute, I had to check. It's like, oh, I won't be able to hear you necessarily if somebody asks a question. Seems like no questions. So the six cases, yeah, would be that which is seen, heard, thought, known, attained, and sought and explored by the mind. Yeah. And this is stream entry, yeah, giving up doubt. This is what conditions doubt, yeah, is by grasping what we've seen and saying, well, this is true because I saw it. Yeah. Well, we saw it, but does it make it true? Is it a basis for a knowledge or an assumption? Yeah. And how often is what we see not a full reflection of the reality of something? Yeah. How many times have we walked by a garden hose and taken a step back? They're like, wait, is that an animal? Because we saw something and we misinterpreted it. Yeah, so we could form an idea or a sense of truth about something and be wrong. And likewise with what's heard, thought, known, attained, sought, and explored. Yeah. And further on in this Samyutta, we have another very popular view, which is the cosmos is eternal. Yeah. So the Buddha says, when what exists, when grasping what insisting on what does the view arise, the cosmos is eternal. And he says, when you grasp at form, when you insist on form, Then the view arises when you grasp at feeling, at perceptions, at mental fabrications, at consciousness. Such a view can arise. When a noble disciple has given up doubt, in these cases, they've given up doubt and suffering, its origin, its cessation, and the practice that leads to its cessation. They are called a noble disciple who's a stream enterer, not liable to be reborn in the underworld, bound for awakening. And so what we see is this work that we do with views is not really fundamentally any different from the work that we're doing with everything, with all the five khandhas, yeah? The way a view comes into being is that we have a viewpoint, right? And from that viewpoint, we see something. This becomes a problem when we decide that that is an accurate reflection of reality, that the thing is this way because of what we've seen. This is not limited to vision either. So a viewpoint can be, you know, an auditory viewpoint, right? You know, for what we hear. Yeah, it can be sensations. Yeah, we're taking in data, and this is a viewpoint, a lens, a window onto reality. And in many ways, it's shared. Yeah. And that helps ground us. Yeah? It's not, you know, we're not necessarily creating it. We're experiencing it. And so we can know because we are experiencing it. It's arising and ceasing. Yeah? Because our very consciousness is arising and ceasing. Therefore, this experience we're having cannot be permanent, cannot be stable, cannot be reliable. Therefore, it cannot satisfy us, cannot be enduring. Therefore, it can't be ours. If it's going to cease, then it's not part of us. Right? If it will ever not be part of us, then it could never have been part of us to begin with. So it would mean that there's no real us. Yeah. If the us is made up of all parts that are not us, well then guess what? What are the odds that there is no us? Makes sense in a logical way, but in order to get here, there's no magic we can do. You know, we talk about samaditti, and so this word ditti is unlike the taints, the corruptions, the pollutions, yeah, the asava. Unlike asava, the Buddha was not like anti-ditti, yeah. Again, this is the word. It's part of seeing. It was seeing, which is synonymous with awakening. Seeing, understanding, verifying for yourself, personally, having an insight. Now, the Buddha was not anti-ditti, you know, but again, this leads to these problems. You know, we can't take on any particular ditti and say that this is samaditti. In some ways, the right view is to be fluid with our views, to be willing to take different viewpoints. That's what we cultivated this morning, and it's what we continue to look at. And again, it's sort of like when waves, you know, crash against rocks, it seems like they're not doing anything. But if we were to sit there long enough, we would see that, you know, actually they are. They are wearing away the rocks. The rocks are becoming smooth. They're becoming smaller. They're developing holes. Yeah. Over time, the same. Our tendency to believe what we see and to think that this reflects reality, that this is somehow true, starts to diminish, starts to fade away, starts to dissolve. And even once we have finally made, and the Buddha calls it the breakthrough, this is really, that's what it feels like once we've made the breakthrough to the realization that, wait, there is no one view. There is no one viewpoint. Knowledge and vision are not the same thing. Like, I will have different knowledges. I will have different visions. There's no one person in the middle of all of that. Once we make that breakthrough and separate the two, there's still some work to be done. But we can still use our views that are arising, because that's kind of how it all started. Yeah. And so the amount of suffering that's left is canonically based on the doctrine, up to 7 lifetimes worth of suffering is still possible to be left over. Now, the doctrine also says that's a worst case scenario. Like you would have to be really attached to samsara to wait around that long. Yeah. You would have to do absolutely no work for it to take 7 lifetimes. But if you were to apply the same fundamental activity of questioning your views, well, that's the same wisdom developing function that you use to investigate your attachment to form, to feeling, to perceptions, to mental fabrications, to consciousness. Yeah. You look at them like you do views, and you look at views like you do them. You say, this is impermanent. This is not going to satisfy me. And this is not who I am. The difference is when we apply this to views, because views and viewpoints are so essential, because they are so, I don't know how to say, because they're it's such a deep level of the mind that we're just not used to thinking that way. Yeah, we're not used to questioning. It's like, well, wait, what is it like when I have one viewpoint? What is it like when I have two viewpoints? What is it like when I had three viewpoints? What is it like if I saw this from over there? We just don't usually do that. But the reality is, our reality is shaped by where we are in the room looking at the reality, right? How we are looking at it, what lens we're looking at it through. Yeah. So if we develop this muscle of questioning viewpoints, it's going to it's going to help us with a lot of the other work. I was just talking with Laura just before we started, that when we start out, it seems like the things that have the most suffering, that are the most solid, seem like we'll never get over them, right? When we start out, we have some things that seem really trivial. We're like, oh, okay, yeah, I'm a little attached to this, I'm a little attached to that, and I have a lot of opinions about this, but it doesn't feel like that big a deal. But then we have that one thing that's just so precious to us, like our children, or this one thing that we own, or our heritage, or a certain viewpoint that we hold, an opinion about the world, and we just hold it so precious, and we're like, wow, it's this attachment is so very strong. I don't think I'm ever going to be able to overcome that in this lifetime. And I just hope that this sometime in the distant future, I'll be able to approach that. What we find as we do the practice is this perception is backwards. Yeah. The thing that we don't feel like we could ever overcome, the defilement we could never conquer, is held in place by the things that seemed really trivial. And so it is with viewpoints, that once we start letting go of viewpoints, we realize that they were the things that were making our greed, anger, and delusion so tangible, so heavy, so impenetrable. They were what created the reality where we could not let go of those things. But once the viewpoints start to crack, these seemingly simple, nonsensical little things. I believe in this, and it's really kind of harmless. I only think about it once in a while. It's no big deal. But it turns out that actually that was capable of generating an infinite number of lifetimes of suffering. It seemed little, but it was the worst. And once that goes, we find that it was the supporting condition to so many things we thought we were, we thought we needed. When it goes, we find there's so many more things that start to appear that we're willing to question and investigate and learn about, and even experience the complete opposite of, just for kicks. Just to, well, what would it be if I renounced that? What would it be if I stopped doing that? What would it be if I gave that up? And we give it a try, and we find that, wow, suddenly it's not scary anymore. Well, why was it? Well, it was only scary when it was us. And when it's not us, it's It's life. Things come and things go. So this is where we do the best work. This is where we soften all of our attachments. Yeah, it starts here with at the very root, with views. So we take this into the afternoon practice and see what we come up with. And again, yeah, you know, I could say, you know, do you believe in a soul? Do you believe in God? Do you believe in the Tathagata existing after death? But realistically, just see if there's anything that gives you suffering. Yeah. And if it's at all possible, imagine where you would have to be to not suffer over that. And this may be a process. You may have to put your viewpoint on the other side of the room. You might have to put it down the street. You might have to point it on the other side of the planet. But just to loosen it up a little, eventually what you see, though, it might be a completely necessary process, because this might seem like, oh, this is serious. I can't let this go. But if you do that process and you kind of loosen it up by seeing it from other people's perspectives, then what you'll eventually arrive at is the problem is not which perspective, it's having a perspective. And we can't just take on a perspective that defeats all perspectives. Yeah, we have to do the work in this way to get to that point where we're willing to let go of them and exist in that space where we don't need to have one perspective on this. Yeah, where we recognize that this is something outside of us, that this is bigger than us. Yeah, and that it would be suffering to cling to it, to say it is like this. So instead, we're just going to look at it and see what it is. That is the solution. Give it a try. It sounded like it was not too hard for people to come up with something to contemplate. So we'll give it a try, and then we'll come back together at 5 p.m. Eastern time. And if anybody's still around, you haven't Nibbana'd out of existence, we have one final chat to wrap up the retreat, yeah?